Hello, and welcome to our new digital dialogue series, where we're going to be learning from some amazing thinkers, activists, and organizers around issues of land, our relationships to land, as well as Indigenous food sovereignty, Indigenous land rematriation, and relational accountability. My name is Sarah Rotz, and I'm part of a large team of settler and Indigenous researchers, food activists, farmers, and teachers who have made this series possible and whose voices you're going to hear throughout the series. So today, for our very first episode, my friend and collaborator, Dr. Adrienne Xavier Lickers, and I are going to be speaking with Dr. Sherry Pictou, who is an assistant professor of law and management and a Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Governance at Dalhousie University, as well as Dr. Martha Stegman, who's a colleague of mine in the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York University. So I want to thank you for tuning in today and sharing in these important conversations, and I'm going to let Adrienne take it away.
I'm Adrienne Xavier, and I am going to start this off with a little bit of an introduction. So I am the Director of Indigenous Studies at McMaster University. I am currently on a contract to do that, and next year I will take over a tenure track position in Indigenous Studies and Anthropology. Might as well do the whole gambit because, Martha, I haven't seen you in quite some time. I defended my dissertation in April, and I got a degree in the mail this week. Graduation is in the fall this year for me, so it's been a very busy couple of years. In my formerly academic adjacent life, I was actually the manager of a food security, food sovereignty program here at Six Nations in Southern Ontario. And that's what the basis of my dissertation was, which was understanding the relationship between community food and the history of our connection to food and land. So by teaching sustainability, we got to teach things like gardening and food skills and community relationship. So I'm still farmer and food program adjacent because I am the in-community scholar with the McMaster Indigenous Research Institute. I am this year's Young Innovator, some award, fancy-pantsy thing to work with undergraduate students. And all of that I do is actually about getting community and students involved in Indigenous research and also in food sovereignty and land relationships. So my portion of the collective is just one small part. And it is very much about relationship building for me because I want to build a relationship with land as much as I do people. Sarah?
Thanks, Adrienne. So I'm Sarah Rotz. I am an assistant professor in the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York. I come to this work from several years of organizing and activism, and got really interested in the relationship between issues of environmental justice, climate justice, and food. And I really started to build my relationship, or start to even make sense of my relationship, I would say, to land and food, maybe even just over the past 5 years or so. And so it feels still quite new. I don't really come from a place or a culture that has a strong, close relationship to land and food, at least in the way that I'm sort of trying to establish or to build or create later in life. And so that's sort of what's bringing me to work around land at a personal level, but there's also a lot of, you know, political questions that I found really important and that I've been learning about over the past few years. And one being, you know, what is our collective relationship to land? Where did it come from? How did it evolve? What is the role of things like capitalism, colonialism, white supremacy, and patriarchy, and how we understand our relationship to land and food growing, and then how has that created the conditions that we see today in our food system, in our land holdings, and in how we go about our daily lives, frankly. And so starting to work with this group, the role of the history and ongoing impacts and structures of settler colonialism, I see how that really, it really underpins how we function as a society today. And so I think that in terms, especially in terms of accountability as someone with white settler ancestry myself, trying to do some of that work and make sense of some of that has been sort of what I've been up to more recently.
My first question is actually very much that introduction. I'll ask it the way that I get asked things at home. I moved to Canada when I was about 10, and a lot of the things that people would ask me were like, who's your parents? Who are your people? And that was how I started learning to introduce myself. You know, I'm Adrian. I'm Donnie's granddaughter. I am, you know, these are my uncles. So we kind of wanted you to start theirs. Tell us who your people are and who you are.
You waiting for me, Martha, to go?
Do it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is such an honor. My name is Sherry Picto, and greetings, by the way, from my ancestral homelands, Mi'kma'ki. That encapsulates about four provinces and part of the United States, but otherwise known today as Nova Scotia. And I'm from a small community, traditionally known as Elsticook, where the water cuts through high rocks, but otherwise known to locate me on the reservation is Bear River First Nation. And I'm currently a professor at Dalhousie University, long story, but I've also, you know, I'm honored to say that just recently I became the first woman district chief for the Confederacy of Mainland Mi'kmaq, which is comprised of mostly mainland of Nova Scotia. That compromise wasn't a slip, by the way. And recently awarded a Tier 2 Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Governance that will focus on gender. And so that's about it for me. I'm sure as we get into the questions and discussions, you will learn a little bit more about me, but that's just a brief intro. Thank you.
And my name is Martha Stegman. And I laughed, Adrian, when you said, who's your father? Because the whole thing in Nova Scotia is, who's your father? Who's your father's father? Anyway, I work with Sarah in the Faculty of Environment and Urban Change at York. And my research is kind of straddles food security, food sovereignty, food justice questions, Indigenous knowledge systems, self-determination, and collaborative sort of documentary film practice, and kind of like where those three areas intersect. My parents are come from a ways, as we say in Nova Scotia. I grew up as part of the settler community in Halifax, but both my parents were immigrants to Halifax from the United States. My father from New Orleans and my mother from New York. And so I'm kind of like a Western European mutt by ancestry, mostly French. And both of my parents experienced Catholicism as an ethnic identity because they grew up in the 30s and the 40s, and I guess there were different times then. So that was a big part of my upbringing. And I guess in terms of who I consider myself to be accountable to, it's, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to learn my responsibilities as a treaty person in Mi'kma'ki, because that's where I feel the strongest attachment, because that's where I grew up. And that has been a journey very much in collaboration and relationship with Sherry and with her community. and others in Mi'kma'ki as well, but El Cid Cook has really been kind of the place that I've done a lot of this kind of learning and this collaborative work. And I also now live in Toronto, Haudenosaunee, Anishinaabe, and Wendat territory. And so I'm also learning about my responsibilities and my treaty obligations here as well. And that's a big part of the work that I've been focusing on the last couple of years.
I'd like to thank you both for sharing that. And could you tell us a little bit about your relationship to land? How has your relationship to land changed over time? And maybe if you're able to connect this with your understanding of the concept of rematriation and what that means to you, maybe how you might make sense of or explain rematriation to others, or maybe there's a different term or concept that you would prefer to use.
Yes, I'm wondering how much of this will be repetitive for dear Dr. Stegman, who's videoed me a number of times, recorded me a number of times. I was very fortunate, though, looking back, I think the way that I was raised, it was very poverty-stricken, but I sort of didn't know that because, you know, and years later, I realized just how resilient, I guess, my people were. But I was very much brought up on the land, and with my aunties, with my uncles, with, you know, and when I mean being brought up on the land, like hunting and fishing and canoe trips and so forth. And so I was just raised that way, even though it was at a time that there was a lot of poverty, a lot of addiction, and a lot of these issues that a lot of First Nations communities continue to struggle with. And I was very fortunate with some of the older people, like my grandmother. I was so blessed to have my grandmother in my life, who practically raised me along with several other elders who had a strong assertion of who they were and that there were treaties and that, you know, my grandmother remembered the freedom to be able to canoe and travel with the seasons and so forth. And so I was introduced to the concept of treaties and so forth. But what coincided with that was a lot of struggle. And a lot of struggle in terms of what I mean by that. And again, thanks to my grandmother, like, you know, as a child or in my early teens, like, what is this all about, trying to fight for treaty rights? What was this Aboriginal position paper? Because she was a former chief, by the way, as well. And she was also vice president of the Native Women's Association at one point. And so as I became older, it became quite clear to me that there was this reserve boundary, and the boundary was even getting tighter, because in some ways, beneath the surface, when you don't have any rights, people don't really pay attention to you, fishing and so forth. But as these rights become more explicit, particularly in the courts, that raises questions. And so in many ways, that boundary even grew tighter. So I was raised on the land, at the connection with the land, but little did I realize how that was minute in comparison to our traditional ancestral lands that went beyond the reserve boundary. And actually, like in my case, in the hunting and fishing district of Gaspouac meant all Southwest Nova Scotia. That's about what equates to that. And so basically, to try not to get, like, I'm a story of stories, so I'm trying to stay on track here. And so, so that was my upbringing. My political awareness was quite young. I carried that throughout my life. And what I'm even noticing more is that those, though we're, you know, this sounds contradictory, that we're struggling to in some cases, reestablish those type of relationships we had to the land and water. But in many ways, it's such an upward battle because, as I said before, as treaty rights and so forth become more explicit in the court system, how they get interpreted and so forth is very corporatist in thinking. And it's a very property ownership type relationship that is trying to be imposed upon us. And what I mean by that is that land and water is very much objectified and it's looked for its bottom line. And this is the type of treaty right that's being imposed onto us. In other words, the only way you can exercise your right is not to be able to fish for food or to gather medicines and so forth, but to extract that fish so that it can be commodified, to extract any of the minerals in the earth so that it can be commodified. And so that is basically our struggle today. And interesting about rematriation, I hear a lot of talk about this. And for me, and I think for a lot of Indigenous women, it's about relationship as opposed to that property ownership. It's about the relationship to the property, but not owning the property, if that makes sense. And interestingly, if you try to look up that term, it never comes up. Repatriation, it will try to automatically to correct. And so it just gives you a sense of how the concept of land and water is very much embedded in property. And what I'm suggesting here is that what I'm learning is that it's not the relationship to that property. It's the commodification and the value of that property and what can be extracted from that.
I mean, I think I first started developing, I was a part of the food movement for many years. I was not just a farmer adjacent person, but I was a city farmer of sorts, city gardener. I ran a network of collective gardens in Montreal. And so I started thinking a lot about relationship to land and thinking a lot, you know, about that connection in that context. And then I met, and, you know, I was becoming more and more aware of, you know, whose land we were building food sovereignty on, and being more and more uncomfortable with the inconsistencies and not really knowing how to begin asking deeper questions about our place as settlers in the movement. When I met, this was in, I guess, the late 90s, and then I sort of met Sherry and a number of other people who were involved in conflict mediation and relationship building between Mi'kmaq and settler fishing communities in the years after the Marshall Decision first came down. In 1999, they recognized the treaty right of the Mi'kmaq people to fish commercially. And so I shifted focus to thinking about food systems and food sovereignty in that context and began learning and focusing a lot on my relationship to land and water and food sovereignty and farming and so on through the matrix of treaty, because coming from Mi'kmaq, coming from Nova Scotia, that's the framework that this is always sort of articulated within. And my first level of learning was about the politics and about, you know, the need to defend a political space for the Mi'kmaq nation to exercise its rights, how it saw fit. But the more that I spent time in community, especially working in Elsa Cook, but also on a project with Elder Carrie Prosper, who's, we worked on a film together called Seeking Nduglamuk, which is the, Sherry will speak more eloquently to this, but it's, you know, the Mi'kmaq law ways that structure sustainable harvesting and relationships with the natural world for Mi'kmaq people. And so I started to think more about the fact that treaties are not moments of, you know, the imposition of colonial law. Treaties are constitutional moments that are anchored in two distinct legal traditions, Indigenous and settler. And so for me to understand my place as a treaty person is to also understand my place in the legal world that settler people joined by creating treaty with the crown. And so, you know, the Mi'kmaq, I mean, talk, you know, this extends beyond Mi'kmaq, but we're having this conversation in the context of our relationship. So, you know, the Mi'kmaq have a legal, have an understanding of relationships with all of creation and ideas of justice and reciprocity and how to conduct yourself in order to honor those land-based, water-based relationships. And settlers were brought into that. And so to honor treaties, to enact treaty relationships and responsibilities is to be mindful of and respectful of that world and those sets of relationships. And so in the last couple of years, I've been thinking about my relationship to land in that context, that I have treaty obligations to respect the lands and waters, because those were the terms that my people were allowed to settle in peace and friendship. I mean, I could also, you know, I could answer that question in a totally different way in terms of the relationships to land that I have inherited through, my Christian upbringing or through capitalism and the settler economy and culture that I live within, that I attempt to challenge, that I attempt to resist, that I attempt to see critically. And if we had 7 hours, then I could go into that as well. And if we want to bring that up later, I could, you know, I mean, I think what I would say is that the way of relating with land that and the relational obligations to land, recognizing your place in a world that's not an anthropocentric world, that all of that directly challenges the relationships to land and to quote unquote nature that I grew up. Well, they do and they don't, actually. Like, I think a lot of the ways that I was raised by my parents, by my father, that fits into that world very easily, but it's not a relation. It's a relationship to land that the culture that capitalist modernity and late stage capitalism has created, it directly challenges that on so many different levels. And so I guess I'm talking about the things that I've learned, and I'm talking about the relationships that I'm trying to honor and seeing those in some kind of ethical framework. But I just also want to acknowledge that that is by no means the dominant culture that I live in and participate in. But it's, yeah. So I hold those two, I guess, relationships to land in tension.
That's, you couldn't have segued into the next question any better, truthfully. Well done. because the question is really that, what aspect of land rematriation and this concept, where does it apply? Is it a physical connection? Is it a philosophical? Is it conceptual? Are we talking about ownership or access? All of that conversation that you just started, and I won't ask for 7 hours. This is one of those things that could go on for, you know, lifetimes, and that's sort of where we're at. But what part of land rematriation do you enact for yourself? Because dominant or not, where does that fit, right? Is this your community's context of it? Is it a process that we're talking about? Or is it a set of principles that you're sort of seeking to live with?
I looked at that question and contemplated it, and I just thought all of those apply. I think you simultaneously, physically, philosophically, and so forth, spiritually, you have to struggle on so many fronts. And I found that a very interesting question. But for me, you know, there's been some talk about rematriation, but really beyond the concept, I think, of what we're talking about here. And I think about some of my holistic, the beautiful river people, or otherwise known as Maliseet women that I work with, and some of the Mi'kmaq women I work with. It's such a broad concept about, you know, when they talk about the relationship to land and so forth. And why is this? I think it's particularly important for Indigenous women and gender non-conforming persons, because what we seem to kind of take for granted, like, for example, the other day seeing something on salmon farming, and the whole world was just so upset that this First Nation decided to take advantage with this industrial salmon farming, and there was a lot of nasty language about, oh, well, they're not the environmentalists that we thought them to be. And Martha knows me. Usually I would jump right on that, you know, because we have those type of internal divisions. And what I'm trying to get at here, why matriation has to be so beyond, I think, of even what we're thinking, is that we tend to forget that this is very difficult work. What are we trying to reestablish relationships with? And just as Martha was explaining, we're right up against capitalist relations that have a historical and contemporary or temporal affiliations with colonialism. And this is, again, one of the most difficult concepts. Colonialism is a difficult concept, particularly to explain to students and Canadian settlers, because we've been taught to think of that in the past, and we don't think about its contemporary forms or how it has expanded and how it's impacted. And, of course, with colonialism, what we take for granted, something that, you know, just true, that I was able to learn later in life, is, of course, is patriarchy. And so all the institutions that are being imposed on Indigenous people, right from the way they elect their chief and council, right up to the current negotiation processes over land, over water, land claims, treaty, so-called reconciliation — that reconciliation just drives me right through the ceiling at times. I'm always saying, we're reconciling to what? But my point being is that those are the structures that Indigenous people are up against. And I sometimes think settler Canada takes how complicated, how multi-layered that is. And though I know feminists understand that to a degree, like you have eco-feminism and all this feminism and so forth, and having worked in women's studies for about 3 years, it really misses the boat when it comes to unpacking what colonialism is, and how that sometimes our fight against patriarchy, we tend to forget that patriarchy and colonialism impacted people differently. And so, that's about what I can say on that. But it's really important for Indigenous women and gender non-conforming people, because they have received the real brunt of patriarchal colonialism in so many violent ways that they, you know, and ways like that legally they were erased even from their societies and so forth. And that's why it's so important. But I would also say it's just equally important for all settler Canada to start realizing, because these colonial patriarchal systems that were imposed upon our community continue to exist. And if they're being imposed on our communities, well, they're definitely quite deeply embedded in yours.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think that one thing that I've learned through our working relationship and through the work that we've engaged in collectively, and other sort of Indigenous sovereignty work that I've, solidarity work that I've done, is realizing, like, the extent to which that those colonial structures, those neoliberal structures limit all of our freedoms and sever our connection to the sacred. And I mean, it doesn't compare in terms of the violence that it enacts daily on Indigenous people, but that, you know, this is, we find ourselves in an ecological crisis because of these systems of power. I have to say, like, honestly, rematriation is not the framework that I've used to think about my role in decolonization and the work that I've engaged in partnership with Indigenous people. So I feel a little tentative in terms of talking about how it applies to me, because I think really what I'm doing in trying to speak to it is collapsing it into what it means to be a treaty partner, for example, or what it means to think about land back, or what it means to think about decolonization. And I don't want to, miss any nuance, I guess, or any of the specifics of what rematriation entails in doing that. But that's kind of the only way that I can kind of approach. I mean, so I think one of the things that I like about the word and about the concept is that it underlines or it stresses the role that heteropatriarchy plays in colonial relationships and in colonial systems of domination. And that hasn't been the focus of my analysis and the focus of my work. But I am very aware of the ways that processes of colonization, ongoing process of colonization, have imposed those heteropatriarchy relationships on Indigenous societies through, you know, the Indian Act, governance, worldview, economy, all of that. And so I like the way that the name, that rematriation as a word, challenges that and really kind of underlines the heteropatriarchy that I live under as well as a settler woman. And I think it calls on me to heighten my analysis of how that works, which I think is a really interesting learning edge to present. The stuff that I would say in terms of how it applies to me would be around, educating myself and other settlers about the ways that settler colonialism has operated historically, but in the present and is always in evolution in relationship to heteropatriarchy and in relationship to neoliberal capitalism, and the way that implicates us in new and ever-changing ways. And building very long-term accountable relationships. Like, you don't walk in, learn the terrain, find a way to be useful, and check out 2 years later because because not only does that kind of, I mean, we've been talking about these like anchoring relationships and layered layers of accountability, but also just the complexity of the situation is such that I feel like I've been in this for going on 20 years, and I still feel like a beginner. I still feel like there's so much for me to learn and to understand. Like, there's this dumpster fire of a situation in Southwest Nova Scotia right now with the Mi'kmaq and treaty-based fishing and DFO. And like, I have spent such a huge amount of my of the last 15 to 20 years thinking about that and being involved in that and trying to understand it and trying to intervene in ways that are useful. And I still am completely mind-boggled as to how to do that in a good way, given the complexity of the situation at hand. And so the idea that you can walk in and walk out in 2 years is just ridiculous. So I guess what it means is building those long-term accountable relationships, understanding that you're always learning, understanding that I definitely think it's a process. I don't think it's a thing. I don't think decolonization is a thing. I think it's a process. I mean, the treaty isn't a thing. It's a process. And thinking about these things as things is, that's what a settler mind does. That's what an English language framework imposes, is that these things are frozen moments, that they're objects. But what I've learned about the indigenous worldviews that we can only catch, that I can only catch glimpses of as a settler, especially through an English, the conceptual straitjacket of the language of English, is that, you know, that we're always in relation, and that things are in constant negotiation. It's not static. And so it's about finding the way to be your best self in that network of accountable relationships. And supporting efforts and trying to find political levers that you can push to, you know, to have have land back, to have jurisdiction back, to support Indigenous people in their processes of strengthening the grounded authority, the lawways, the social structures that have been so attacked by settler colonialism.
I want to just add to that, if I may. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just one sec. I want to do something here to speak to Martha's relationship with my community. And I really appreciate your saying that, because, you know, when I talk to my chief, or when I was doing my own PhD work, people are still very leery of researchers, and because they've never seen anything that was of benefit to them or so forth. But one of the things that I've always appreciated with Martha is when she talks about building those long-term relationships, she does. And I wanted to show you this. Can you see that? That's a picture of my daughter, but I think she might have been about 6 or 7 that Martha took. If I don't get emotional. And I just seen her son the other day, and I didn't recognize him. In my mind, he was this little boy, and you know, time does a weird thing. And here he's this 9-year-old and this almost tall as Martha dude. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, we are aging here. And that's how long our relationship has been. And it's quite a story that I think that her and I still have to explore and write about at some point. But, you know, she's one of the few researchers that just didn't abandon us, that just didn't come in, get her degree and go. And in fact, I know it's been more difficult lately with everything that's going on. And our latest project was in 2015. And because of a lot of circumstances beyond our control, we're just starting to write about that now. But when she talks about taking that time to build relationships, I just think that's so key. And that's so difficult for universities to understand, because everything's under a time frame. And you've got so many time, you know, you got to do this, got to do that. And particularly when it comes to funding and research and stuff. And one of the things throughout her degrees, right up and including her position now, she's worked with us. So I had to do that, because my daughter is now 22, going on 23, and she was just out searching for wedding dresses yesterday. So that's how long our relationship has been. And that with my community as well.
You make me blush.
Thank you both so much for sharing about your relationship and how it's changed over time, and your research relationship. That's really amazing. So I'm just wondering if you can share a little bit about some of the questions and concerns that you might have with land back or rematriation in practice, or how settler peoples and institutions might interpret it or take it up in potentially problematic ways.
Yeah, I have, that's a very complicated question because I have concerns on so many levels. And, but when it comes to, let's start with the academy, the academic institution, my concern is, and it's a shared concern amongst other Indigenous scholars, that there's so much reliance on Indigenous scholars to educate, if you will. And I'm so done with it. And I'm now to the point, well, take the time to go out and learn, take the time to go out and learn, which is what Martha did. She did a lot of the heavy lifting, and this is why she's just so appealing. Like, researchers like that are so appealing to Indigenous communities because there's somebody willing to listen. And so in terms of matriation and in terms of even Indigenous relationality with lands and waters, I think we have to do a lot about property. And because my main concern is just like the salmon story that I told you about, the open pen salmon farming, when settlers got so upset. And it's not, you know, one thing they have to understand is that capitalist colonial patriarchy is so embedded that when we win treaty rights and land claims and so forth, it's always with a caveat of, in terms of political and economic legislation, that yes, okay, you have a treaty right, but that treaty right gets interpreted as that this is the way you're going to exercise it. And so, you know, it's surprising for me to say this because I've been heartbroken so many times. I've seen my people having very few choices other than those who do stand up. And it's often women that are on the front lines defending their lands and waters with their bodies. There's very little choice within those formal processes of what you can do. And sometimes communities suffer on account of that. It's the communities that will, you know, embrace that, those capitalist ideas, and sometimes out of desperation because they've been oppressed and living in, you know, such abject poverty for so long, that that's the only choices that are available to them. And I think we have to really understand that those are the only choices. Where does that come from? It comes from, again, this valuation of property as something to be owned and something to be commodified. And so I have a little bit concern about that. And so when we talk about our relationships to the land and water, and I've seen a lot of good allied ships, a lot of partnerships, if you will, rather it's with academia, government, in some cases, you know, business, it'll only go in so far, but as that it is that property capitalist paradigm is not interrupted. If you go to try to break through those boundaries, well, then that relationship will be broken off. And I worry a little bit about that. And there's a lot of education that still needs to be done about that. There's a lot of still fear, particularly with even land back. Now there's various interpretations of what land back means. Does it mean access? Does it mean relationship? Does it mean actually physically given land back? And even with the best of allies, if it comes down to giving land back, for number one concern, and I've been on calls, I think I've been on another call here a couple of years ago with Martha in another context, the first fear is that, oh, you're going to take our land. And we can't even get to the relationship building because it's about this land. And so those are some of the concerns. And the other thing, too, is that with the talk of rematriation, and even to some extent, I've in other circles to talk about, how can I put this? let's address the concerns of Indigenous women and gender nonconforming people and so forth. Again, it's only insofar that it will be within that system. For example, you're hearing a lot about, and I was going to talk, I'll probably talk about this here in a bit, the gender-based analysis in terms, but it's like what I've heard. So when we do impact assessments, and then when we do impact benefit agreements, particularly with Indigenous communities, how can we, you know, include women and gender diverse persons in that? So it's still assimilated into a very patriarchal system. And what I mean by that, it's not just patriarchy for this, you know, it's patriarchy even in how our land claims and treaty rights are being resolved in the courts and implemented. They are predominantly male dominated industries. And so the answer is coming back saying, oh, well, we've got to make sure that the women somehow economically benefit without really looking at those broader structures of what am I trying to say here? I'm not being anti-development. I think there's good, sound economic development, but we're being forced into positions of exploiting the land and water in ways that they will not be sustainable. And in doing so, you're wiping our places from where we derive our lessons, from where we derive our language, from where we derive our culture. And so in essence, we're being forced in our own demise. Anyways, I'm sorry you hit a button there. I got a little bit emotional about that. So.
Mm. That's incredibly powerfully put. How am I supposed to follow up on that?
You've been with me on this journey, Martha.
What Sherry said. I mean, I have a hard time imagining, how can I put it? The settler state hasn't shapeshifted enough for me to be able to imagine it participating in land back. That as a call has not been co-opted sufficiently for me to be able to entertain the way that it could be, or rematriation. That hasn't, you know, it has been co-opted enough for me to be able to imagine the way that it could be overdetermined by, you know, neoliberal capitalism and heteropatriarchy in the way that, you know, state dominated process of treaty recognition have, or impact benefit agreements, the kind of token sort of inclusion to fit, you know, dominant political and economic processes that Sherry just described. But Sherry, when you were talking about, you know, property ownership and land ownership and domination and that kind of worldview that all of these systems of exploitation are grounded in. It was reminding me that part of our job as allies is really kind of is challenging that worldview and its expressions in on all of the fronts that we possibly can. And I was thinking about the food movement, and I was thinking about how, you know, I think it's really interesting that when Don Morrison and Kathleen Neen came back from Mali, which you were at as well, Sherry, back in like, what was that, 2007 or something? And Don advocated to add that seventh pillar of food is sacred to the food sovereignty pillars. And I remember how, like, I got it. I knew where it was coming from, but it still felt pretty far out for me. Like, how are we going to incorporate that into the food movement? It's so, like, it was so far outside of the conversation. And how today it's not outside of the conversation at all. And that's kind of, I think it's, might not be understood wholeheartedly, but it's understood. It's part of the conversation. You know, when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission came out with the report in 2015, I remember, you know, being at CAFS, at the Canadian Association of Food Studies, and talking about how what it would take for Indigenous people to be centered in the food movement. And I don't want to say that Indigenous people have been centered in the food movement, but, you know, in the last 5-6 years, every food organization worth its salt now has Indigenous people on staff, now is acknowledging that part of their work involves having some kind of relationship to decolonization. It's by no means perfect. There are still huge frustrations within our movement spaces in terms of how token Indigenous people have been included in quotation marks, the limited leadership spaces that folks have been able to really kind of occupy in any kind of full way. But I mean, I guess I'm speaking more from like the settler perspective here, obviously, but, you know, any kind of substantial land back, any kind of substantial rematriation is going to happen as part of a larger social movement. And it's going to happen through some kind of alliance. And we all have roles to play in that. And if the, I don't want to say that if the gains that Indigenous people make are not going to be co-opted, like the gains Indigenous people make are constantly being in danger of being co-opted by settler government processes. And as settlers, we have a responsibility to challenge that. That means that we have to have political analysis that's sharp enough to see the way that that's happening. And we also have to have the political power to be able to mobilize and actually try to affect that change. And that's going to happen through social movements. And so we're not going to be able to diagnose and recognize that unless we're working together. Because settlers will not, I don't think we're going to be, I haven't been able to learn that. I haven't been able to see that except through the learning that I've done in dialogue, in collaboration, in solidarity with Indigenous people. That has been where I've learned how to see that the worldview that I was brought up within, that the processes that govern my world, I wouldn't have been able to see that those were not universal unless I had been in relationship and unless I had been attempting to be in service of other goals. And so I think that part of this project involves settler allies working in solidarity with Indigenous people in all of our social movements. No matter what social movement that we're involved in, we need to have some kind of relationship to this process. And that's going to involve making real space, real accountable space within our movements for those conversations for that joint work. And so it really involves work on all the levels, right? Like you need to have the structural analysis. In order to be able to get to the structural analysis, you need to be able to work on yourself so that you're not going to be a white asshole dominating spaces. and yeah, that is where I will leave it for now.
Very succinct. I like it.
Don't be a white asshole.
That's right. that's my new bumper sticker. I think that's really the only material or resource that I need actually after this. The next question is, we can skip right past it. Bumper sticker. Don't be a white asshole. Got it. Check. I really like your style, Martha.
You heard it here first, people.
That's right. Interestingly enough, the questions that we've asked for me, and I'm going to pull this just as an aside for a second. When we started this, we were working with the National Farmers Union. So when you frame questions, and that's the context that people have, if this conversation began because there are, and I say actually, like it's like they're unicorns, there are actually farmers out in the world who want to allow for Indigenous communities to get their land back or find ways to share that relationship of that land. Rather than just taking it, right? Sherry, when you said, you know, we're being we are doing to ourselves and taking from where we derive our lessons and our culture. If we're actually talking about putting those things back or allowing communities to rebuild that relationship in some way, not necessarily, because I also agree with you, Martha, that, you know, dominant culture isn't just going to be like, you know, land back is cool. That I think we should do that. I don't want my cottage in the Muskokas anyway. It's fine. I don't need waterfront property in the Kawarthas. It's okay. That's not going to have people. I wouldn't do that. If I owned that stuff, I'd be like, you know, I will happily share this with you. You can fish over there. I'll take just one fish. It's not taxes. It's called sharing. It's relationship building. But for me, when we ask the questions, I'm super mindful of trying to create them in a context of asking and all of the sort of adjacent people, settler adjacent, farmer adjacent, indigenous adjacent people, and not even necessarily allies, because now that just, like, I feel like there is something to be said for standing beside someone. And being there, just being beside someone really makes a difference. But you guys are talking about a relationship that you've obviously done things, not just talked about, not just stood beside, not just, you know, come up with ideas. You've actually built things. So in the work that you have done together in your communities, What are the ways that you're seeking to access or build and create that community for other people? Because if we could bottle up the relationship that the two of you have built with your communities, and I say your because, Martha, you have invested in your community, even if you are not from that community, you know, then more people would be able to. I'd like it to become sort of an invasive species at this point. If we could have more people just doing that sort of thing, but what is the true work of that? What did it really take?
It's a very small question. Super simple. You know, yeah. I was thinking about two things, you know, what you're saying, Adrian, that, about, you know, standing side by side, and then all of ours and Martha's work, and then the current context of a community that's not necessarily from my district, but trying to assert what their version of what a treaty right is, and how it's played out in the media as sort of us and them. And putting those three thoughts together, I did a lot of considerable work with my community and through Martha, but through a lot of other people too, to reach out to, and at that time, in the height of the Donald Marshall Jr. court case decision, to reach out to non-Indigenous communities. Because I had a little girl, she was just a little girl at the time, and I knew she would be attending school with other fishermen's children. And that was a tremendous, long, hard journey. Very difficult journey. And I was trying to think about if those group of fishermen were, you know, local fishermen, local to my community, were a group of farmers. And I suspect it would still be a hard, tremendous journey, but it's about bravery and getting through the rough parts, learning to agree to disagree and so forth. So many stories on that road. And so when last fall it happened, and it's starting to rear up again, and of course the media is pushing this as that, oh, this is race, this is all this stuff, bad DFO and so forth, and there's some truth within that. My first reaction was, oh, well, nothing has changed, all of that work for nothing. That's your first kind of response. And this is why it's so important, like when Martha was talking, you have to be in this for the long haul. And I've been reflecting on that in the past year, and I thought, no, it's a relationship. It's having the bravery and the courage to establish a relationship. And so far, this particular, and it's much more complicated, this particular time of what's going on in my own back door, that's not happening. And I had a dream about this not too long ago, and I don't know what it was. You know, I don't know if I can explain this, and I'll kind of leave it at there. Indigenous worldviews that, you know, that's been suppressed and so forth. So wonder they were suppressed, because they're so interrelated. Like Martha was talking about the difficulty to conceptualize that spiritual element and so forth, but they're so interrelated. And this is half the reason why I took an interdisciplinary degree, because it's so difficult to settle into a health mode and more to a environmental, because they're all connected. And when you think about it, we as people are all interconnected. But there's so much that we do to, number one, separate us from nature. We've been taught to dominate it. We've been taught, and capitalism has a lot to do with that. So let's exploit nature and so forth. And number two, to separate from each other. So it takes a tremendous amount of courage to stand side by side. And quite frankly, I've been saying for years, if you ever want the success of a social movement, that's it. The last thing that those protagonists, those capitalist protagonists want to see is Indigenous and non-Indigenous standing side by side. And the other morning, I don't know why, I'm still trying to contemplate it, and I have no idea why this happened to me and so forth. It was an aha moment, but I'm having a difficulty expressing it, that by me separating from the non-Indigenous fishermen, by cutting off, the French Acadians, by cutting these people off, I am no better than the government that is trying to separate us. And that is a difficult thing, particularly when you're on the receiving end of oppression. And it just takes that courage, because we have been systematically taught and raised in how our systems are that we cannot build relationships with one another. And that is what has to even happen in these current cases. There's been no opportunity to build those relationships. And it's a little bit more complicated than what I'm saying, but just to sum it up, and Martha has heard this story, is when the Donald Marshall Jr. case, when it was upheld in 1999, we were basically told that we shouldn't talk to non-Native fishermen because we had rights. We didn't need to talk to them. Non-Native fishermen or non-Indigenous fishermen were being told, oh, don't worry about the Native. We're dealing with that. You don't have to talk to us. And so it kept the government in a position of power for some time. The best thing that can happen is you cut out that third dimension and try to meet. And that has happened. And we have several stories around that. And so my long thing is that I think we have a long ways to go, but it is possible. There's so many side stories that I could tell of relationship building of very beautiful people, you know, and very beautiful people that has worked with us. But ironically, it's the system that does not, you know, so the social movement to me is in building those relationships. That's the social movement, build the relationships. And as Martha was saying, sometimes it's the process, not the end product. It's the process, because maybe back 15 years ago, we weren't successful on a number of political stages, but relationship, yes, where we were able to become allies and other issues such as, you know, pollution and quarries and so forth. anyways, I don't know where that came from, and I don't know if that's helpful, but I'll leave it there.
I would say that it's not just courage. That's like what you're talking about is kind of a superhuman grace and compassion and generosity and moral depth that involves courage, but that goes far beyond. And it reminds me of a teaching that you shared that you got when you guys went on the study tour out west from an elder in Nechalna territory. You talked about how your responsibility was to all of life on your traditional territory, including the settlers. But I mean, to be honest, I haven't really gotten to the place of hope that you were articulating in terms of the situation with the fishery in Southwest Nova Scotia. I mean, I'll start with the hopeful part, which is that I think that that the conversation around treaty and around fishing rights and the general sort of political literacy in the population in general and in the social movement community in particular has really shifted in the last 10 years, 10, 15 years since our films came out. I'm not claiming that we're the ones who changed that, but we were part of something that has shifted, you know, we're part of a movement that's shifted things in that respect. But I mean, what I'm kind of feeling the weight of in the last year, thinking about what's going on in Gaspésiac, which is the traditional district of South, that's basically analogous to Southwest Nova Scotia, is how hugely powerful all of the forces that we're trying to work against are, and the significance of the task at hand. Because I mean, even with the incredible relationship building efforts that Bear River undertook, even with the kind of incredibly unique, one-of-a-kind sort of conflict mediation processes that happened after Marshall went down, even after the kind of work that we've done together, like even after, you know, the kind of fisheries tables that our friend and colleague Arthur Bull was mediating in the years leading up, you know, to last year between the Mi'kmaq fishing representatives and the non-native fishing representatives and the industry and the chiefs around the table, like even with all of that kind of relationship building, even after all of that work, even after all of that political literacy, even after all of those constant dialogue tables, things are still blowing up in the same way that they did 20 years ago. And
I disagree with that, but you go.
Oh, good. Yes, disagree with that. Disagree with that, please.
Yeah, I don't want to turn this into this debate. I've been very reluctant to comment on it because every community has its own politics.
Yeah.
And there's circumstances that are so complex beyond this conversation here.
Totally.
But I think the two situations are very different. And
good.
The response, maybe not so. However, I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that in terms of the position that the community has held in the fishing industry and yeah. so forth. And I think that's why this is just so very complicated. And I can't sort of get into it, but I do understand because I felt exactly that way, you know, and why now? Why wasn't this type of help, you know, there for Bear River and so forth? And I just think that after 20 years of being assimilated into the fishery, and then all of a sudden you do a turn about face. It was just too much for settler Canada to take. But it does speak to how difficult it is to put in an alternative vision. And it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's very difficult for me to speak about. And I've been just trying to facilitate processes that bring a little bit more understanding. But it's safe to say that there's a lot of internal debate in terms of what even a treaty fishery is. And that's still continuing. What are we talking about? And so there's a lot of internal debate amongst the Mi'kmaq community themselves, the Wolastoq people themselves, in terms of what that is. And so, yeah. Anyways, not that I totally disagree.
No.
It's a little bit more complicated than I think. And that's the unfortunate part, that when the media speaks to this, they elevate the racial tensions. And I wish they would spend just as much time, that those racial intentions are important, but just as much time of unpacking the complexity of this, and that there are 12 other Mi'kmaq communities in today's Nova Scotia, 30-some, including the Maliseet or the Wolastoq people. And so it's a little bit complicated in that sense. However, to even get food, you know, that's become so commercialized now. And Martha, as you well know, you wrote about this, what a struggle it was to get even fish recognized as food.
Hold my downer comments at the end.
Yeah.
So you've already sort of covered the first part of the question that I wanted to ask, so I'll throw in a second piece to it. But if you have anything further to add around what responsibilities settler peoples have in relationship to land back and rematriation, and what that might look like on the ground in everyday practice, for instance, in terms of treaty relations. But as well, if you have any links or want to make any connections to food sovereignty and how settler responsibilities around land back might relate to calls for and actions around Indigenous food sovereignty.
I owe a lot. Really, this, you know, I went on this journey with Martha all about the treaty and so forth, and really I wanted to find out what, you know, I pretty well knew what was happening at the political tables and how treaty was being I'll get to the food sovereignty bit, don't worry, but how treaty was being framed at those tables. And then this is my daughter, but so I wanted to know what my own people thought about treaty. And it's very interesting to live all your life with your own people and to give them that space to define what treaty meant to them and so forth was just so life transforming for me. And the reason why I say that is because food was the priority. You could not talk about treaty without talking about food. Now, is that because Bear River stayed out of the commercialization for so long? We're getting a little bit into that and so forth. But, it was just wonderful. But then towards the end of that work, Elder, she's passed on now, she reminded me, which I just kind of took for granted, that how much in my particular community is that young women are fishing and hunting now for food. And so this was the turn for me in terms of looking at the patriarchal elements of colonialism that I think we take for granted. Why were women not allowed to vote in their own chief and council elections? Why were they not allowed to run in those elections up until 1951? Why were they the ones who lost status when they married non-Indigenous people? Or why were they the ones who were forced to move? Whereas if a non-Native woman married an Indigenous man, she gained status and so forth and all of these things. And the long of the short of it is that we are now embedded, as you've heard from both mine and Martha's journey here, in very much capitalist relations that are taken over treaty and land claims and these type of negotiations, to the extent that no alternative vision is allowed. Even with what's happening in Southwest Nova, this is a proven point. You can come forward with any type of vision, but if it doesn't conform to the status quo, it's not allowed. And I'm a little bit, if I was a little bit, a sense of hopelessness, it's there. But the other side of this story, it has to do with extracting resources, rather it's fish, rather it's mine, whatever it is. And what we tend to forget, again, these are capitalist relations. They're very predominantly male-dominated type of ways of making living. And they get prioritized over our food. And that's what's happening. And so Indigenous women, a lot of movements across Northern Turtle Island, what we know as Canada, are in the forefront because they know the sacredness of that water. They know those berries, or they know the fish that comes out of that river and so forth. And this has put us at a precarious situation. But is it related to the food sovereignty movement? You betcha. I see it, but now this is even more complicated, and Don Morrison is sort of ringing through my ears here with this. This has been very difficult to achieve in terms of when you look at the food sovereignty movement, particularly with international social movements like La Via Campesina, that is predominantly pastoralist agriculture and so forth. It's very difficult, though I think we're making some headway, to try to see how Indigenous other forms, like we have Indigenous agriculturalists as well, but other forms of food, and like the fish, like the medicines, and hunting and so forth, how that is also a source of food. And I think when we look at our relationships back to land, that we have much more opportunity to broaden our what we can conceptualize as a food sovereignty and movement in order to transform or sort of transcend some of these capitalist relations that are being imposed upon us. I don't know, I kind of lost my train of thought there. I don't know if any of that made sense.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's very much, and the first thing I think about, you know, is I was raised being able to go clamming, to dig clams for food. And now not being able to do that for all a host of reasons, but that was how I was raised. The old people would take me to the, and we would, you know, we would dig clams, and there's a whole host of reasons that we cannot do that now. And it's all to do with industry and so many levels, the clamming industry itself, but the pollutants and so forth and that. And so when we see land defenders so defiant and ready to put their bodies on the line, and it's for a lot of things, but fundamentally it's food. And so there is some strong connections there. And also water is life. And we have to think of water like we have the drinking advisories on reserves and so, but we have to start thinking of water as lakes, water systems, oceans, and so forth. And so lately I've been qualifying my land base with land and water to try to bring that notion home. Anyways, that's a long-winded answer. I don't know if it answered any of your questions, but
thank you, Sherry, that was great. I mean, I don't know what I've spoken to, you know, sort of the food sovereignty movement and changes within it and needed changes within it already. But I mean, I guess just thinking about, you know, my understanding of the food sovereignty movement globally is as a peasant sort of response to the corporate dominated industrial food system dispossessing people of their traditional means of subsistence. But it feels to me like there's still a lot of conceptual work before it gets translated accurately to the sort of Turtle Island context, to the North American context, because that dispossession happened with colonization. It's like 150, 200 years old. And we're so integrated into that global machine our food system is, that what it means to respond to that, just it feels like it means something a little bit different here. And it feels to me like Indigenous, that rematriation or Indigenous sovereignty or land back has to be part of that sort of understanding and that conversation. And I mean, I think I'm thinking about a kind of a debate that Sherry and I have been engaged in terms of a paper that we're trying to write about Mi'kmaq food sovereignty, where we keep not liking the word sovereignty. And if you look up the word sovereignty in the dictionary, it's about dominion and dominance over. That is the frame. And that's the crux of the problem, right? That's kind of the key, you know, the colonial magic. It's the keystone of the empire. It's what we need to get past. So even as I think in terms of this sort of conversation about, maybe it's the conversation about rematriation. I've already spoken to my kind of hesitancy around acting like I have a very fleshed out understanding of what that word means. I think there's a lot to sort of still to unpack, even in terms of our framing of it, that this work is a part of.
I spent the first 2 years of my master's trying to explain why I wasn't studying food sovereignty. And mostly because I didn't think that I was, because I looked it up. I did the same thing that you're talking about. And asking for things like food balance doesn't translate. It's, first of all, it's not catchy. Nobody's like, yeah, food balance, self-control of your food system. You know, they don't have the same ring. It's just Indigenous food balance sounds funny. But I could never come up with something. And I classified it as food security for my master's, and I classified it as community building for my doctorate. Because I struggled with that same question that you guys are talking about, is I believe in a relationship to land, and I'm the same, Martha. I walk tenuously when I talk about rematriation, because like everything else, there are, I can't convince another person to understand it the way that it makes sense in my head. So even things like land back, where, you know, my community is in the news all the time because, you know, and I'll just, I talk about this with our collective. Skylar Williams is like a vocal, you know, face in the news of land back, because he has a responsibility to his community and to land. And I see him as my niece's biological dad. This like sort of dorky, shows up late to all of the family functions. That's the dude that I see. So I'm ever cognizant of the fact that like what we see in the world is never really what we see when we're at home. Food sovereignty works that way. Rematriation works that way. Food security even works that way. Right? Like everything has its fine-tuned balance. But I have to be mindful, and I think you guys, I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, it's a complex thing, because I was always like, for, you know, food security isn't strong enough. We need food sovereignty. I went through all of that learning process, and later in life, I'm thinking, wait a minute, we're using terms like territory, sovereignty. And then it dawned on me, this is because of the legal cases. So we're using legal terms. But I think food sovereignty, and why I had aspired to it initially is because there is something a little bit more radical about it, proactive about it than food security. However, on the bigger scale, when I look at what does this mean for other countries, what does this mean? Who's really dominating the system? Like, I can't contain, Martha and I have had this debate too. I somehow am at home in international circles than I am, you know, at my, in my, even in my homelands. And I'm always thinking about those bigger issues, that there's enough food to feed the world. Who's really dominating the system? So as food sovereignties, you know, it's one thing to claim sovereignty for food for yourself, but what does that really mean on the global scale? You know, and I know we're not going to resolve it overnight, so it's quite complex in that way. But the term sovereignty, so I thought, well, you know, wait a minute, what makes this so indigenous? Is this really, from an indigenous perspective, is this really any more indigenous than the court case when we talk about sovereignty, or when Canada talks about sovereignty? And let's face it, I've found evidence where sovereignty is up for sale. You know, we sell sovereignty all the time with trade, free trade agreements, with the flags of a convenience agreements in the shipping industry. And so sovereignty is up for sale. And so that's something just to be mindful of.
I have nothing to add.
I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. This was such an inspiring and nourishing conversation. And I hope you have a good trip, Sherry. And thank you, Martha. Bye, everyone.
Very nice.
Yep, you too, Sherry. Absolutely. Okay, bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
I want to thank you all for tuning in to our very first episode. And of course, thank you to Sherry and Martha for sharing so much about their work and experiences. So please look out for our upcoming dialogues with some more amazing thinkers and scholars and activists. And I'd also like to thank my fellow collaborators and friends, Taryn Giacomini, Lauren Kepkowitz, Danielle Boissonneau, Adrienne Xavier Lickers, and Ayla Fenton. And also thank you to our research assistants, both past and present, Jessica Ross, Jaron Richards, Stephanie Morningstar, and Sonia Hill, for all of your wonderful work, and Jaron for your tech support. We'd also like to thank the National Farmers Union and the Indigenous Solidarity Working Group for their ongoing collaboration and support. Okay, well, that's all for our very first episode, and thank you for listening.